The contemplation of hope, the theme of this talk, arrives at a fitting time. Like many journalists, I suffer from a form of news addiction. I wake to the sound of the Today programme. I spent much of the day dipping into the bear pit that is Twitter. And along the way, I absorb as many articles from print media as I can. All of this is a tremendous help in keeping track of where fast-moving cultural and political arguments are headed, which frequently seems to be in 20 different places at once. But recently I've been noticing an intensifying side effect of my addiction, a kind of mounting spiritual exhaustion like a pervasive fog. In between news of galloping coronavirus, racism, riots, climate change, refugee crisis, and nuclear proliferation, it can be hard to see much light. It doesn't help that the causes of so many of these are global rather than local, so that while failure implicates us all, finding solutions also feels far beyond one's individual control. Nor does the suspicion that many among the current order of world leaders score significantly lower on the altruism index than their predecessors. At such times, curiously, it almost helps me to remember that in the place and time in which I grew up, Northern Ireland in the 70s and 80s, civic society was in a kind of meltdown. Our local news was studded with paramilitary atrocities on both sides, and the electricity of potential violence was so constant that I didn't fully realise it existed until it eased with the mid-90s ceasefires. But there was also a great deal of laughter and the capacity for joy during that time. And very importantly, there were a number of courageous people steadily trying, in varied ways, to make the world around them better. I was recently watching a piece of archive film footage from Belfast at Christmas in 1977, a time when the city centre was cordoned off and shoppers had their handbags searched for explosive devices. Amid the army Land Rovers and the heavy police presence, there was Santa Claus giving children rides on a horse-drawn carriage, a towering Christmas tree outside the city hall, and Protestant and Catholic churchmen at a cross community carol service talking to the reporter. The Protestant clergyman said, "I think the situation here is improving, and we're looking forward into the new year with great hope this time. More hope than we've had for a great number of years, I feel." It's poignant to watch, because of course the following year, 1978, did not bring an improvement, but some of the most terrible incidents of the Troubles, from the IRA bombing of the Le Mans Hotel to Loyalist paramilitary murders of Catholics. Killings led to other killings in spirals of retaliation. The violence continued unabated for another 16 years, up until the paramilitary ceasefires of 1994, and sporadically beyond that. So was the clergyman wrong to be hopeful in 1977? No, because hope was the ingredient that made survival possible. And although the word carries with it the sense of looking forward, of expectation, which is how he used it in the interview, it is also about a way of conducting oneself in the present. So hope is a word that exists in two time zones, the future and the now. When I look at that little film of a militarised Belfast, the markers of hope, the Santa Claus, the decorated tree, the children carol singing, all attested to a determined belief in a shared normality that might one day become the full reality. But even if that day had never arrived, hope had already altered the landscape of Christmas 1977 for the better. In 2007, 30 years after that film was made, I went to interview the poet Seamus Heaney at his home in Dublin. We started talking about hope because the line from his translation of Sophocles' The Cure of Troy, "The longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme," had been much quoted around the time of the 1998 Belfast Agreement. He said to me that in his Nobel lecture, I quoted with great pleasure Václav Havel on hope. His view is that it's not optimism, but it's something worth working for. I was interested in this idea, but only recently did I go directly to the source to see exactly what Havel had said. The first quote I found was this, which echoes Heaney's recollection. Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. The book from which that quotation was taken included other passages in which Havel was more expansive. The kind of hope I often think about, especially in situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. Hope is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. I feel that its deepest roots are in the transcendental. Havel knew the potential cost of giving into despair, because it must have felt very close at times. As a dissident and outspoken opponent of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, he was under constant surveillance and spent a number of years in prison. But then hope is always fighting against some kind of prison, literal or metaphorical, whether it's depression or an immobilizing anxiety or a claustrophobic and violent political conflict. And it's worth saying that the absence of one kind of prison doesn't automatically mean that individuals will be spared another. In the years since the Belfast Agreement, for example, more than 5,000 people have died from suicide in Northern Ireland, significantly more, in fact, than were killed in the Troubles. For many people, the peace was much hoped for, but the peace didn't necessarily deliver hope. They're not the same thing. But throughout the darkest years of the conflict, there were ordinary people who consistently acted for the common good, often defying the inflammatory separatist logic of the paramilitaries in order to do so. They did the low-key, patient work of trying to knit a fractured society back together. Teachers who fostered a pupil's talent or dealt with trauma. Emergency workers who plunged into terrifying situations to help victims across the divide. Doctors who did their best for each and every patient. If Havel defined hope as a state of mind, not a state of the world, then during the Troubles it existed in those who persisted in doing their jobs with constant kindness without concern for further acclaim. Hope of that essential, everyday kind has a continuing meaning in the world we find around us today, in which it suddenly feels as if history is moving very fast and unpredictably. Different as they are, in both the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movements, many people have glimpsed the hope of dynamic change, of a world in which women and black people respectively no longer encounter structural discrimination and routine disrespect, whether that is of a relatively minor or a more devastating kind. Alongside this hope, there have often been expressions of anger, triggered not only by the release of long-held resentments, but also the perception that in recent years political progress on addressing racism and sexism has not only stalled but gone into reverse. One might add to that the widespread inequality in income and security in the UK, which has undoubtedly damaged our sense of national coherence, and recall the warning of the Black American writer James Baldwin, that if a society permits one portion of its citizenry to be menaced or destroyed, then very soon no one in that society is safe. Precariousness is contagious. But in achieving the projected hope of a better, fairer future, there is also a powerful need for the kind of quieter, more immediate hope that Havel and Heaney spoke of, the orientation of the spirit, that derives from the certainty that something makes sense in the present. That comes from the hard daily graft of understanding each other, and it manifests itself most clearly in the level of courtesy with which we listen and talk to one another, something that matters more than ever in electrically charged times. As someone who is both a journalist and an author, I often now feel as if that understanding is more likely to be helped by reading broadly in fiction, which allows for voluntary immersion in radically different lives and perspectives, rather than the oppositional platforms of social media. The explosion of new arenas for discussion and the sharing of information on sites such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube has speeded up the news cycle and allowed for the rapid creation of mass reactions, which quickly take on great force of numbers. From it has arisen a punitive culture of public shaming, which can be intimidating when its adherents suddenly advance at top speed towards an individual or institution, demanding demonstrative reactions such as sackings and retractions. These campaigns are often conducted online, where they give the appearance of powerful consensus, something that might not be borne out by consulting the populace as a whole. Much of the rhetoric on Twitter, for example, is that of division and fragmentation of sex, race, age and class, forcefully and furiously reiterated. A lesser amount, although certainly some, speaks passionately and thoughtfully of a shared future. But our society is at a kind of crossroads. We can start to listen to each other carefully, with an expanded generosity of imagination for the hopes and fears of people with different experiences to our own. Or we can descend into competitive anger. The future path depends partly on how that conversation is conducted. We saw in Northern Ireland how a national conversation about change could turn ugly. Early on, state force was misapplied, and paramilitary force was awaiting its chance to erupt. Identities were simplified and weaponized. I can see those same dangerous possibilities in the US, and to a lesser extent in the UK, today, particularly in the economic chaos that may follow the coronavirus, but I strongly hope they won't be realized. The best inoculation against them is by attempting to consider the certainty that something makes sense in each decision we make, broadening our ability to listen and adapt when necessary, while also showing courage in the face of mounting ideological feverishness from both right and left. Sometimes that will mean understanding the necessity to enact meaningful change swiftly. At others, it will mean resisting pressure to do what appears instantaneously popular over what may be right. And throughout, it will depend on retaining a stubborn belief in the power of mutual goodwill, discussion, and persuasion. That's a hard and complicated line to walk, but hopeful people have walked it before. They will do so again.